This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This week, the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrived in the Middle East for his fourth visit in 3 months. This time, he said, the main aim of his trip was to ensure that the Gaza-Israel conflict, dreadful enough in itself, doesn't spread and become an all-out regional conflict. On Tuesday in New York, the UN Security Council adopted a resolution demanding that Houthi rebels on the coast of Yemen, who have ostensibly been acting in solidarity with the Palestinians of Gaza, immediately cease their attacks on merchant and commercial vessels. Meanwhile, exchanges of fire continue across the Lebanese border between Israeli forces and those of the numerous and well-armed Iranian-backed militia, Hezbollah. So, are we witnessing the expansion of the war in Gaza to one engulfing other parts of the region? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First of all, let's start by identifying the flashpoints with the BBC's security correspondent, Frank Gardner. Frank Gardner, outside Gaza and outside the Palestinian West Bank, what's been happening in the region as a consequence of the events following October the 7th?
Well, rather a lot. I mean, just to give a quick upsum of this. First of all, in Lebanon, you've had the assassination of Salah al-Aruri, Hamas number two. Big shock to everybody. He was killed by a drone strike in a Beirut suburb that was widely assumed to be an Israeli targeted assassination. You've got a low-level conflict on the Israeli-Lebanese border that's getting slowly, gradually worse. 80,000 Israelis have had to evacuate from northern Israel. Thousands, an unknown number, have had to evacuate from southern Lebanon. There's tit-for-tat exchanges of fire, rocket fire, missiles, some casualties. But it's contained. It's not the all-out war that people feared. You've got a number of small attacks taking place in Syria and Iraq, sometimes from Syria into Israel, sometimes by Iranian-backed militias in Syria and in Iraq against US bases. But I think perhaps the one that is most likely to blow up into a full-scale shooting war is what's going on in the southern Red Sea, which is where Iranian-backed Houthi rebels, they're called rebels because they took over the Yemeni government illegally in 2014, but frankly, they are the de facto government now in Yemen. The Houthi rebels are targeting any shipping they consider to have Israeli links. They've got it wrong several times, and they are making it an extremely dangerous place to be. A US-led flotilla is trying to stop these attacks.
Okay, so Frank, let's start with what's been happening in Lebanon. Are there significant dangers of an escalation arising out of what's happening in Lebanon?
Yes, absolutely. Although the immediate fears that were sparked by the Israeli, well, everyone assumes it was an Israeli assassination of the Hamas number two, Salah al-Aruri, in Beirut, those seem to have abated because there was a huge fear in the region that Hezbollah was going to be a red line crossed. But the Israelis, assuming, as I say again, that it was them that carried this out, made this a very carefully targeted assassination. They waited for there to be no Hezbollah people in that room when they sent the drone in to blow up Salah al-Aruri. Now, obviously it triggered protests, but it hadn't sparked the regional war that people feared.
Right, so that's Lebanon. Let's look in a tiny bit more detail about those attacks you've been talking about in Syria and Iraq.
These attacks are really a kind of proxy for Iran's ongoing fight against both what it sees as Israel and America's presence in the region. Iran has something called the Axis of Resistance. That's another word for a kind of galaxy of proxy militias that it has been funding, training, arming, supporting, and encouraging right across a whole swathe of terrain across the Middle East. These proxy militias are very much controlled and directed by Iran. They are mostly Shia. They are in Syria and Iraq. And every now and then, they will carry out drone strikes on the really very small number of US forces that are still remaining in Iraq and Syria. So there's a force of about 1,100 US, mostly special forces, on the Syria-Iraq border. They're there to try and stop ISIS, so-called Islamic State, re-emerging. And the weird thing is that when ISIS was defeated several years ago, the Americans and the Iranian militias were on the same side. Weird.
So that's Lebanon and that's Syria and Iraq and some of the other places in the region. So let's now talk about the problem that you have identified as being the greatest threat, which is what has been happening in the Red Sea. Now, just remind us, Frank, exactly what has been happening in the Red Sea, how long it's been going on, what the scale of it has become.
This is a really serious problem that extends well beyond the Middle East because it is raising fuel prices and creating shortages in commodities. Why? Because since the middle of November, the Houthis, who are the Yemeni tribesmen that control the Red Sea coastline of Yemen, have decided that they will target any shipping that they think is having Israeli connections, whether it's visiting Israeli ports or partially owned by Israeli government or commercial interests. And they say they're doing this in support of their brethren in Gaza, in support of Hamas, because they are part of it, the Iranian-backed Axis of Resistance. This is playing very well in the Arab street. So although it's a massive nuisance to the global shipping industry and it's being condemned by the UN, it's quite popular with a lot of street cafe chit-chat and social media in the Arab world because the Houthis are seen as somebody who is standing up and doing something for Gaza in their eyes, which is one of the reasons why, perhaps the main reason, why the US-led naval flotilla that has assembled, it's a task force there, it's called Operation Prosperity Guardian, it's assembled in the Red Sea, 12 countries, the most important ones are the US and UK because they've got the kind of warships that can shoot down these drones and missiles that the Houthis are using to target shipping. And the Houthis have gone beyond that. They have hijacked a big container ship, the Galaxy Leader. It's now become a tourist attraction in Hodeidah. They tried to do something.
Hodeidah, which is a Yemeni port, I imagine.
Yes, indeed. It's the main Red Sea port on the Yemeni coast, Al-Hodeidah, which they control. And they tried a few days ago to hijack another container ship, the Maersk Hwangju. And according to the US Navy account of it, the Hwangju put out a distress call and US Navy helicopters scrambled. There were four Houthi speedboats. Unwisely, they opened fire on the helicopters and they got an awful lot of lead in return. It sank three of the boats. One fled. 10 Houthi died in that. And that has triggered a huge popular protest against the Americans in Yemen. And while we in the West would probably see the US-led force as trying to safeguard shipping, in the Arab world, there's a risk that it's seen as somehow defending Israel and taking sides on Israel's side in the Hamas versus Israel war, which is why we haven't yet seen any direct action against Houthi bases.
Now, Frank, both you and I managed to be in the Gulf at the time of the Somali pirates and so on, and in the areas around there. Would you describe this threat to shipping as significantly worse than that threat was?
Yes, I would. I mean, I've sailed up through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait and up through the Red Sea on a ship and we got pinged by pirates. We got circled by them. They had boarding ladders. They had RPGs. They had AKs. But they weren't out to actually sink ships. They were after money. But in this case, what they would love to do, I think, even though it would risk a massive retaliation, is to punch a hole in a Western warship.
Frank Gardner. So we've heard about the disruption to this important international trade route through the Red Sea, But who exactly are the Houthis, the group that's been involved in a civil war in Yemen for nearly a decade? And why are they hijacking boats in order to support Palestinians? Here to explain more is Dr. Elizabeth Kendall, specialist on Yemen and the Middle East and mistress of Girton College, Cambridge. Elizabeth Kendall, who are the Houthis?
The Houthis take their name from their former leader, Hussein al-Houthi, who died or was killed in 2004, and their current leader is his brother, Abdul Malik al-Houthi. So it might sound like they're a tribe, but they're not a tribe. They have tribal roots, but they're better described as a political, military, religious grouping that hails from the north of Yemen. Now, religion plays a really important role in their identity politics, and they grew out of this movement called the Believing Youth in the 1990s. And in fact, their political arm today is called Ansar Allah, Partisans of God. They're mainly Zaydi, that's a branch of Shiism, but they're not exclusively Zaydi. And by the way, Zaydism, it's not the kind of Shiism that you have in Iran, Twelver Shiism. It's slightly more moderate and a bit closer to the kind of Sunnism branch of Islam that you find in Yemen.
And are they a fully fledged government, in effect? I mean, in other words, do they have ministries and civil servants?
Well, they have a supreme political council, and they do have appointees in charge, but they're still very much ruled by the family, the al-Houthi family. And it's worth saying that they are not natural democrats. They have increasingly supremacist views. They believe that they are entitled to rule because they're direct descendants from the Prophet Muhammad.
Is it the case at the moment that the civil war in Yemen is sort of suspended?
The civil war in Yemen has certainly eased off since a truce was signed in April 2022, but it would be definitely wrong to think of Yemen at peace. The Houthis have been involved in a civil war in Yemen for the last 9 years. 9 years later, we're still here, and the Houthis have only grown in power.
Now, let's talk about what's happening in the Red Sea. As far as you can see, why have the Houthis taken it upon themselves to hijack or attack ships in the Red Sea?
The Houthis have several motives for hijacking ships in the Red Sea. They're domestic, they're regional, they're international. On the domestic front, this is a great opportunity for the Houthis to frame themselves as the heroes, as the defenders of Palestine against Israel and America, the enemy. And not only does that invigorate their base, pretty exhausted after 9 years of civil war, but it also wins them broader support in Yemen because there's a lot of sympathy for the plight of the Palestinians. And the Houthis are able to speak out in a way that the internationally recognized government really can't. And then at the regional level, the Houthis manage through these attacks to increase their leverage in the ongoing talks with Saudi Arabia. Saudi is trying to exit the Yemen war, and it certainly doesn't want to see the Houthis further antagonized at a time when it's almost about to get out of the Yemen war. So the Houthis have managed to win some significant concessions from Saudi Arabia. And then internationally, well, the Houthis gain maximum publicity for themselves in a way that they never have throughout the whole course of the Yemen war, and for the Palestinians. And they're ensuring that the rest of the world feels repercussions, consequences from Israel's actions in Gaza. I think we can look at the Houthis as just one more front in Iran's encirclement of Israel. If you look at a map, it's really striking how the groups that Iran controls in its so-called axis of resistance actually sit in a circle around Israel. To the west, we've got Hamas in the Gaza Strip. To the north, we've got Hezbollah in Lebanon. Then we've got the Iran-backed Shia militias in the east in Iraq and in the northeast in Syria. And the Houthis complete that circle, lying to the south of Israel in Yemen and the Red Sea. I should add, David, that we sat on this show almost exactly 7 years ago, and you asked me, as we talked about the Yemen civil war, why should we care about it? And one of my answers was because whoever controls the Bab al-Mandab has a chokehold on global trade. And that's why the world should wake up and watch. 7 years later, here we are, and that's exactly what's happened.
You've talked there about the connections with Iran and the way in which, by and large, the Houthi question has been reported here has been to see them as essentially a kind of extension of Iranian policy. Can you tell us the extent to which you think that's true?
The Houthis could not operate at this level without Iranian arms, training and intelligence. But it's important that we don't see the Houthis as a direct proxy of Iran in the way that, for example, Hezbollah in Lebanon might be seen as a direct proxy. It's a case that their interests align and that the Houthis embrace Iranian support for their own interests, and they're enthusiastic for these attacks in the Red Sea for their own reasons. Their slogans, of course, align. The Houthi and Iranian slogans, most famously, death to America, death to Israel, a curse on the Jews, and victory to Islam. But it is the case that if Iran decided to withdraw its support for the Houthis or perhaps wanted to stand them down, it's not at all sure that the Houthis would follow, because it's unclear that Iran has direct command and control over the Houthis. The Houthis could just keep going.
Do you think that the Houthi leadership has calculated, however, how the international response might pan out? Because there's an awful lot of speculation that the Americans and others are not just going to sit by and let them do this forever, that eventually somebody's going to say, well, we've got to start taking out some of the Houthi targets in Yemen.
I think that is a concern that the Houthis will have thought about. Now, logically, the Houthis would not want to push America and its allies into an all-out war. And the reason for that is that they are in this political process inside Yemen, which stands to give them recognized political authority in some kind of shared government. So actually to be on the cusp of winning is not something they would give up lightly. Why would they therefore provoke America into an all-out war? The problem here is that we should not imagine that the Houthis operate entirely by logic. After almost 20 years of on-off war, if we count their internal wars in the north of Yemen, they are very, very used to war as a way of life. They have a high tolerance for casualties. They have a remarkable indifference to the misery that their actions inflict on their own populations. They are very confident. They feel like they've won against Saudi Arabia in the civil war. And they're not afraid of America. They watched America and celebrated as it retreated rather shambolically from Afghanistan. And then most importantly, they really do believe that God is on their side. So it's not a simple calculation. There's emotion and there's religious belief that needs to come into this equation.
Elizabeth Kendall. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes a look at the UK and the European Convention on Human Rights, which explores the government's Rwanda plan, plus, are there aliens out there? Now, back to the Middle East. Having heard about Lebanon and Yemen, we now need to ask the question, how easily could the Gaza-Israel fighting lead to a regional conflict? Here to discuss this with me are Jane Kinnamont, Policy and Impact Director at the European Leadership Network, and Scott Lucas, who is Professor of International Politics at University College Dublin's Clinton Institute. Jane Kinnamont, can you sum up for me what the state was of regional relationships in the Middle East before the October the 7th attacks, how everyone was generally getting along?
Well, many of the leaders in the region hoped that 2023 would be the year of mending ties and starting to normalise relations between various countries that have been at odds with each other. Of course, it wasn't quite as planned.
So those countries would be which?
So really wide ranging. And I think, you know, Saudi Arabia has played a big part in that because of its beginning to normalise relations with Iran with the help of China, and also discussing what normalisation with Israel might look like. But it was wider than that. You saw Qatar making friends with everybody again. You saw Turkey and the UAE patching things up. And you saw Bashar Assad coming back to the Arab League.
The Syrian president.
Exactly. So at least regional leaders were trying to find ways to talk to one another to help manage conflicts. But there's been very little ambition for really addressing the root causes of conflict and building peace within societies. And of course, not all countries and groups have been included, especially the Palestinians, who generally felt that the normalisation between Gulf countries and Israel was going to come at their expense, not to help them.
That Scott Lucas, we heard from Frank Gardner earlier about assassinations in Beirut, about rockets being fired over the border and some attacks in other parts of the Middle East. And there's been a lot of speculation about Iranian involvement in these attacks and the possibility that Iran might itself be interested in a regional conflict. How do you read Iranian intentions and those events in the light of what you know?
So, for example, with the Iranians, while they restored diplomatic relations with Saudi Arabia after a seven-year break, it wasn't that you're going to have an Iran-Saudi alliance in any ways. It was more that Iran was trying to take some pressure off of it as it continues to be under international sanctions, as the dispute continues over its nuclear program, and as it's trying to maneuver as the head of this so-called axis of resistance that it wants to call itself, which includes Hezbollah, includes Hamas, includes the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and includes the Houthis in Yemen. And so what the Iranians had been doing through 2023, before October 7th, is continuing to talk to these groups about various plans, which is, all right, what are we going to do vis-a-vis Israel? And especially, what are we going to do vis-a-vis Israel's normalization, not only its effort to normalize with Saudi, but in fact, the successful attempts to renew relations with, for example, the UAE, with Bahrain. And in many respects, the Hamas attack on October the 7th was not one that was ordered by Iran. It was not one that I think Iran even knew was coming on that particular date, but it was an operation which was within the realm of possibility that Hamas could take this action, both for its specific local interest versus Israel, and also in a wider front to disrupt that normalization between Israel and Arab countries.
Do you think, Jane, that these sorts of events, no matter what the kind of big picture beliefs of the major actors, have the capacity within themselves to start a conflict which maybe those actors didn't originally want?
Definitely. That's what we saw with the 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah, which was triggered by a Hezbollah incursion into Israel and kidnapping, and triggered a huge war, which subsequently the Hezbollah Secretary General said he wouldn't have chosen had he known Israel would react like that. And that seems quite plausible. And history is littered with these kinds of miscalculations, because at the end of the day, the underlying conflicts in the region have not gone away. The region has some coping mechanisms to try to stop them bursting out into uncontrollable violence, but things could go wrong at any point.
Scott, looking at the situation as it's developed in the last 3 months, in addition to Antony Blinken's attempts, do you see attempts by these regional actors themselves to try and keep a lid on things?
I think on the one side, for example, you get Israel saying, okay, while we're fighting in Gaza, we're going to intimidate others from coming after us or from escalating. And that's why the assassinations have been carried out. Not just the assassination of Mr. Al-Arouri, the deputy Hamas leader in Beirut, but before that, the assassination of Iran's top commander in Syria, Saeed Razi Mousavi, on Christmas Day. And then after that, the assassination of one of Hezbollah's leading commanders, Wissam Taqiyo. So that intimidation is, we're going to push you back. But the question is, what if the other side decides we don't want to be intimidated? You're not going to call us. And that brings us to, for example, as Frank Gardner and Elizabeth Kendall talked about, the Houthis and their attacks on shipping in the Red Sea. Because those attacks, of course, have an economic effect, forcing ships to divert around the Cape of Good Hope. But it's also a psychological effect, where the Houthis, who in part are acting out of their own interest and in part are acting out of collaboration with Iran, are saying, Israel doesn't have it all its own way. We're going to carry out our own acts of intimidation against Israel, and indeed a threat to the international community.
What we're talking about, despite what's happening in the Red Sea, which seems to be the most problematic, and what's been happening across the Lebanese-Israeli border is a general reluctance by the big players to have this get out of control. And I suppose what I think the listener might want to know is under what circumstances and what set of accidents could conceivably lead to the wider conflagration, Jane?
I think there will be a regional escalation, but it is a matter of time. I think we are already seeing violence ticking up, but there is an element of deterrence going on. Hezbollah doesn't seem to want to get drawn into a war with Israel right now, but that's mainly because it wants to keep its powder dry so that it can help protect Iran if there's a future bigger conflict between Israel and Iran, which people have been predicting and imagining for about 2 decades. Or it could simply get to the point that Hezbollah comes to see that it can't keep its credibility with its own supporters in the face of continued assassinations without some kind of retaliation that goes over an Israeli threshold. There's a lot of possibilities, but I think the structural conflict is there and will get worse without an ambitious political agenda to fix it.
Scott Lucas, we know that there is a significant economic fallout from the attacks on shipping in the Red Sea. And this is an election year in America where the economy is pretty important. Are the Houthis, by continued attacks, not effectively goading an American president in the election year to do something significant to deal with them?
I don't think the Houthi attacks in the Red Sea have the immediate effect on U.S. electoral politics. I would possibly think differently if most Americans, or in fact some Americans, knew much about Yemen, where there is the prospect of an escalation of, let's call it, indirect war, is by really challenging the American military establishment and the international economic community, in a sense, by saying, we can hit these ships, what are you going to do about it? If it gets to a point where those drones cannot be downed and where the Houthis board ships in the Red Sea, this is then a threat to security as the Americans frame it in terms of U.S. security linked to international security. I think that's probably the most likely scenario right now for an escalation of, let's say, hot war, rather than, for example, Iran or Hezbollah preferring a type of hybrid warfare where they're trying to use political measures to try to isolate the Israelis, to try to get the upper hand in the court of world opinion.
Jane, how much do you think that the US is wanting to use its influence to bring the Gaza conflict to an end as soon as possible, the military part of it, as soon as possible, for the reasons of the conflict itself? And how much do you think it wants to do that for the reasons of increased instability in the region and throughout the world?
The US is still not calling for a ceasefire and has opposed UN efforts to call for a ceasefire. I think it's more about trying to limit the regional escalation. That's where most of Blinken's diplomatic efforts seem to have been concentrated, and increasingly to try to persuade the Israeli government not to make some of the open comments about expelling Palestinians or getting them to migrate. They want a scaled down, more targeted operation in Gaza, but they don't seem to have any proposal for bringing it to an end.
Jane Kinnamont there with Scott Lucas. My thanks to them and to Frank Gardner and Elizabeth Kendall. And my conclusion, the big powers, including Iran and Israel, may well seek to avoid a regional escalation, but there are other forces at work that they don't necessarily control. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Nick Holland, Kirsty Knight and Charlotte MacDonald. The sound engineer was Neil Churchill and the editor is Richard Barden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Will you please welcome the 2023 BBC Reith Lecturer, Professor Ben Ansell.
I don't think anybody expects to be asked to do the Reith Lectures, so it's an enormous honour, but it's an enormous responsibility.
Hello, I'm Anita Arnand. In this year's BBC Radio 4 Reith Lectures, Professor Ben Ansell explores our democratic future and what we must do to protect it.
Democracy is our legacy from past generations, and it's an obligation of ours to secure for future generations. It's up to us.
That's the 2023 Reith Lectures. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.